They serve the state of Israel, and they share what I would maybe describe as the Pete Hegseth school of international law, that due process is no process, and it doesn't matter that we never saw a judge, a jury, never saw our lawyers or a prosecutor, we're never charged with anything. This is just a fraction of what we know Palestinians who are still in these torture and detention camps, 11,000 of whom were taken from Gaza alone, let alone the West Bank, are suffering on a daily basis. This is what happens to, you know, white Westerners, in my case, a Jewish American, humanitarian workers who are simply trying to deliver basic critical aid to the starving people of Palestine.
David Adler, we want to thank you very much for being with us, co-general coordinator of Progressive International, who participated in the Gaza-bound Global Samud flotilla before it was intercepted by Israeli forces. We'll link to your article, I Spent 5 Days in Israel's Desert Prison. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking in Santa Fe, New Mexico on October 17th after the showing of the film about Democracy Now! Steal This Story, Please. That's at the Lensic Theater, October 17th. On October 18th and 19th, the film will show at the Woodstock Film Festival. And I'll be speaking along with the Oscar-nominated filmmakers of Steal This Story, Please, Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl, and Karen Renucci, the producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. You can check our website at democracynow.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, judges on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals seem skeptical of Oregon's case against National Guard deployment. President Trump opposes annexation of the West Bank, and a new partnership in Northeast Oregon hopes to better prepare the region for wildfire. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 9th, 2025. I'm Althea Billings. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals heard arguments in the Trump administration's push to end a temporary block on National Guard deployment in Portland this morning. The three-judge panel seemed skeptical of the lower court decision and the arguments from Oregon and Portland seeking to block the deployment. The judges questioned whether they even have the power to put a limitation on National Guard deployment if the president believes it's necessary. Much of the conversation was not surrounding the facts on the ground, but the beliefs of the president and the legal meaning of the word rebellion. The Trump administration had a list of incidents dating back to June of occasional conflicts with law enforcement at the ICE facility in Portland. Here's an exchange with Oregon Assistant Attorney General Stacey Chaffin and Judges Ryan Nelson and Susan Graber.
Certainly the statute doesn't identify for us the form that the president's determination needs to take. And if the defendants are relying on a social media post, that social media post still isn't, it doesn't represent a colorable assessment of the facts within the range of honest judgment. Within that document, the president references Portland as war-ravaged, which we all know is not accurate. And then it also calls Portland under siege, also an inaccurate statement. Because these are inaccurate statements, they can't form the basis of a colorable argument under 12406.
Well, that may be true, counsel, but you're not denying. I mean, what we heard from your opposing counsel is there's really not a lot of dispute on the facts. There might be dispute as to which facts are relevant. Do you think there's a dispute of facts as to what's happened in June, July, August, September? I mean, are there points in time where you think you have a disagreement on what's actually happened with opposing counsel?
I think we disagree with the framing, but I would direct this court to the district court's findings regarding those facts. The district court found that the Portland ICE facility protests were small, less than 30 people, largely sedate and generally peaceful.
That's clearly erroneous, because there's clearly been protests that were above 30. I mean, unless you're trying to limit it to certain time periods, we have evidence in the record that there were protests as much as 200.
It was generally small.
I think there were three instances where it was large over that time period. But when we're talking about how to, as you say, frame the facts, can you go on to answer my other question, which is what is a rebellion, and what is the standard that we should be applying?
A rebellion is an open, organized, or armed resistance to an established government, or an attempt to change the government or the leader, usually through violence. That's the appropriate definition that this court should adopt in this case.
And where does that come from?
The older definitions in Webster's. And I would highlight for the court that the first time that rebellion was added was in 1861, and that was shortly after the Confederacy declared independence and the first shots were fired at Fort Sumter. And it's with that context in mind that we should interpret the word rebellion. And
What about the Whiskey Rebellion?
The Whiskey Rebellion certainly comes into play as well, but I think
inform our definition of rebellion, or was that the president acted under some different provision?
I'm sorry, I don't know the exact answer to that question, but I can say that the defendant's proposed definition here is so broad that it could potentially encompass a significant amount of protected speech and protest activity.
Judge Nelson in particular didn't seem to like the idea that the president loses his rights to deploy the National Guard just because he didn't deploy them back in June. Judges haven't ruled yet, but say they will as quickly as they can. District Court Judge Karen Immergut's temporary restraining order on troop deployment lasts until October 18th, unless the appeals court rules otherwise. President Trump and his cabinet members are comparing leftist ideology to some of the world's most violent extremist groups. At a White House roundtable Wednesday afternoon, officials said a loosely connected network of anti-fascist activists is, quote, just as dangerous as designated terrorist organizations, including MS-13 and Hamas. KPFA's Lauren Schmidt reports.
Antifa was the focus of a roundtable discussion held by President Donald Trump and a dozen right-wing social media influencers, several of whom claimed they had been attacked while either reporting on or attempting to infiltrate the leftist group. Last month, the president designated Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization, despite the fact that many experts say Antifa is not an organization at all, but rather a loosely connected movement of ideology centered on opposing fascism and far-right extremism.
The epidemic of left-wing violence and Antifa-inspired terror has been escalating for nearly a decade.
The discussion also focused on recent events at Immigration and Customs Enforcement facilities, particularly in Portland, where Oregon Republican leaders claimed that Portland was burning to the ground. In a social media post that paired the statement with a dramatic image of a fiery protest. But fact checkers later determined the image was actually a Getty photograph of a South American riot taken more than a decade ago. Among the guest speakers were two content creators who Trump said were assaulted by Antifa in Portland.
Only days ago, Nick Sautor was assaulted in Portland by a flag burning mob, and we've made it a 1-year penalty for inciting riots. We took the freedom of speech away.
Trump referenced his August executive order directing the administration to prosecute anyone who burns the American flag, despite a Supreme Court ruling that flag burning is a protected act of political expression under the First Amendment. But according to reporting by The Guardian, Trump's claims are contradicted by police reports and video evidence, showing that several right-wing influencers in Portland have acted less as journalists and more as agitators, repeatedly provoking confrontations while filming protests outside the ICE facility. The most notable comments from the roundtable came from the Attorney General and the Homeland Security Secretary, who hinted that government actions against individuals who align with Antifa may be forthcoming.
And as you made clear, Antifa is a domestic left-wing terrorist organization. We saw what's happening in Portland and Chicago, and you saw what happened in Dallas. No longer. This is not activism, it's anarchy.
Pam Bondi said she has sent a memo to all federal officers, including the FBI, DEA, and others, to protect ICE from Antifa.
Fighting crime is more than just getting the bad guy off the streets. It's breaking down the organization brick by brick. Just like we did with cartels, we're going to take the same approach, President Trump, with Antifa. Destroy the entire organization from top to bottom.
DHS Secretary Kristi Noem echoed similar remarks, calling for the eradication of the group.
We will get more and more information about the network and how we can root them out and eliminate them from the existence of American society.
While all who spoke during the roundtable were conservative influencers, each claiming that Antifa was a terrorist organization, they offered no evidence to support the claim. At the end of the meeting, President Trump turned to his Deputy Chief of Staff, Stephen Miller, and instructed him to look into declaring Antifa as an international terrorist organization.
If you agree, I agree. Let's get it done, okay? Let's get it done. Steve, are you okay with it?
Yes, it's true. There are extensive foreign ties, and I think that would be a very valid step to take.
Good, I think so, too.
Yes.
A move that, if enacted, could make providing support a federal crime and potentially strip away First Amendment protections for political speech. For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
Historically, President Trump has had seemingly unwavering support for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But in a rare break, he says he will not allow Israel to annex the West Bank. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more.
Yesterday, Donald Trump announced a deal between Israel and Hamas, with both committing to the release of the Israeli hostages. A Trump advisor and a Qatari prime minister had joined representatives of the two bodies at peace talks in Egypt. Today, Trump vowed not to allow Israel to annex the occupied West Bank, assuring Arab leaders that he would block any such move. Israeli officials had suggested in recent weeks that their government could move to seize control of at least some parts of that land. Trump said, quote, "I will not allow Israel to annex the West Bank. I will not allow it. It's not going to happen," end quote. Possible annexation appeared to arise in response to many countries, including the United Kingdom and Canada, moving to recognize a Palestinian state. Trump has strongly supported Israel in the past. His comments constituted a rare instance of pushback against top Israeli officials. The timing is interesting. Israel has been expanding settlements in the West Bank, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is scheduled to visit Washington, D.C. on Monday. Trump appears proud of his close relationship with Netanyahu, but he has faced pressure from Arab leaders who have publicly expressed concerns about Israeli annexation. The United Arab Emirates has warned that any Israeli move to annex would be a red line. Israel captured the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip in the 1967 Six-Day War. The Palestinians want all three territories to form their future state. The Palestinians and the international community say annexation would essentially end any remaining possibility of a two-state solution, which is widely seen as the only way to peacefully resolve much of the Arab-Israeli conflict. There remains some skepticism about Trump's ability to compel Netanyahu, especially since he criticized a recent Israeli attack on Hamas officials in Qatar. Netanyahu has been under pressure from key coalition allies to strengthen Israel's control over the occupied territory. They seem to have hoped that Trump's history of broad support for Israel's policies would help in the effort to expand that control. More than 500,000 Jewish settlers now live in the West Bank. The international community still largely views the settlements as illegal and an obstacle to peace. Recognizing Palestine could certainly increase support for a two-state solution. Some 10 countries, including Britain, France, and Australia, have done so this week. Israel's current conservative government strongly opposes Palestinian statehood. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 62. Today in history, in 1969 in Chicago, the National Guard is called in to suppress demonstrations over the trial of the Chicago 8. These activists were charged with conspiracy related to their anti-Vietnam War protests. The quote of the day is from Yugoslavian novelist and Nobel Prize winner Ivo Andrić, who wrote, quote, "From everything that man erects and builds in his urge for living, nothing in my eyes is better and more valuable than bridges. They are more important than houses, more sacred than shrines, belonging to everyone and being equal to everyone, useful, always built with a sense, on the spot where most human needs are crossing. They are more durable than other buildings, and they do not serve for anything, secret or bad." The Supreme Court considers loosening rules for candidates to challenge election laws. Pope Leo encourages bishops to voice concerns on immigration policies as federal court gives Trump control of the Oregon National Guard. With those stories and more, it's Zimone Perez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
If you ask candidates, would you like to win this election by 60% of the vote or 51% of the vote? I think 100% of the candidates are going to say, I'll take the 60%.
Speaking for an Illinois Republican congressman, former Solicitor General Paul Clement is arguing to the Supreme Court that his client has standing to sue to overturn a state law that allows the counting of late mail-in ballots. Representative Mike Boast won, but had to pay staffer 2 weeks as ballots postmarked by Election Day arrived and reduced his margin of victory. The state is arguing that saying any candidate can sue over election rules would cause chaos and clog the dockets. A federal appeals court is temporarily letting President Donald Trump federalize two Oregon National Guard units. He's still barred from deploying the soldiers anywhere in the state. Trump critic and former FBI director James Comey has pled not guilty to charges he lied to Congress. He may move to have the charges thrown out on the grounds of selective prosecution. Trump announced on social media that Israel and Hamas have agreed to the first stage of a Gaza ceasefire. The agreement could return all the hostages and mean humanitarian relief for nearly 2 million Palestinians. Pope Leo XIV is urging U.S. bishops to openly object to Trump's immigration crackdown, restating a position Leo and the Church have long held. El Paso Bishop Mark Seitz tells the Catholic News Service he's given the Pope letters for migrants who escape repression in other countries and are terrified that they could be returned.
We're going to send you back to Cuba. We're going to send you back to Venezuela. We're going to send you back to Afghanistan. Does that mean that crossing the border seeking refuge in the nation that is made up of immigrants is now a capital crime?
Democrats and Republicans are no closer to a funding agreement to end the government shutdown. Vital federal employees like staff at VA hospitals or air traffic controllers are still working, although without pay. Boise State political scientist Charles Hunt says that still open facilities like national parks, conditions will get worse the longer the shutdown lasts.
Maybe in some cases you can still access these national parks, but they aren't going to be well cared for. There aren't going to be people cleaning the bathrooms or taking care of the trail.
Republicans have pushed for a continuing resolution at current funding. Democrats are demanding the extension of Obamacare insurance subsidies cut in the GOP mega bill to make room for tax breaks for the wealthy. Cuts to the federal agency that monitors threats to election cybersecurity is prompting concern among local officials. Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes says it almost looks like the reductions to the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency are intended to weaken election integrity just when it's needed most.
It's like, you know, you've got an army advancing against a castle and you let down the drawbridge instead of strengthening, you know, your defenses. It's confounding why the administration has chosen this path.
The Trump administration says the cuts are part of its trimming waste from the budget to reduce the deficit and make the government more efficient. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The new Assistant Secretary of the Interior has been confirmed during the government shutdown. Trump's Navajo pick for the role, William Kirkland, was confirmed on a party line vote. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Trump's Navajo pick for Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs was officially confirmed Tuesday during day 7 of the federal government shutdown. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
Senate Republicans confirmed William Kirkland among more than 100 Trump nominees along party lines, while Democrats, including Arizona Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, voted against it. Kirkland, who is Navajo, pledged to work with lawmakers to address potential budget cuts facing Indian country during his July confirmation hearing.
First of all, it's unfortunate, but tribal nations have always been asked to do more with less. Whatever dollars are allocated towards the Office of Indian Affairs by Congress, we're going to work to make sure that we get the best investment.
Kirkland enters his new interior role at a time when more than half of all staff agency-wide are furloughed. Now those nearly 31,000 federal workers and many more may not be guaranteed back pay, according to a White House memo. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Indigenous people in the Arctic have been using underground food storage for thousands of years, but the practice is changing as the environment warms. Researchers have been looking at how villages in Alaska and Arctic communities in other countries are reimagining the future of ice cellars. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Naiden has more.
Several wooden boxes poke up above ground along the coast in Savunga on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. They are a few feet deep and are now empty, but traditionally they are filled with walrus, reindeer, and whale meat. Ice cellars, or sikluaks in Yupik, are common throughout Alaska Native communities, but the Arctic has been warming almost four times faster than other parts of the world. Researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks have been studying how food preservation practices have been changing. Yoko Kugo is originally from Japan and is one of the researchers who is leading the project.
We heard that some communities, not all of them, but some are having a hard time rely on storing food underground.
Kugo and other URIF researchers have been visiting the communities on St. Lawrence Island, as well as on the North Slope. They learned how food preservation practices vary depending on local landscape and diets. And they heard from residents that permafrost thaw and erosion have been causing some of their ice cellars to collapse or flood. Despite the challenges, many continue using ice cellars and hope to preserve the practice. Another UIF researcher, Michael Koski, has been working on the project as well. He says that while the climate is expected to get hotter throughout the century, underground, the temperatures should fluctuate less.
If they're willing to go a little deeper and a little further inland, there's more of a chance of making a new cellar and maintaining those traditions.
During the most recent meeting in Savunga, residents asked researchers about climate predictions and stressed the resilience of indigenous people in face of environmental change. Kugo says that overall, residents ask them about practical takeaways from their research.
They are looking for what they can do together.
While researchers are nearing the end of the social science part of the project, climate evaluations are continuing. Collaborations with other countries will go on as well. In Anchorage, I am Alena Naitin.
On Wednesday, Cherokee Nation leaders in Oklahoma signed an order officially establishing Cherokee Nation Flag Day to be celebrated annually on October 8th. The day commemorates October 8th, 1977, when the Cherokee Council started the process of developing a new flag design. Leaders say the flag represents Cherokee Nation history, culture, and sovereignty. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Northern Blues Restoration Partnership is bringing together state and local partners to better prepare Northeast Oregon for fire through prescribed burns and other methods. Research shows that controlled fire is an essential part of keeping many Oregon forests healthy. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
The Northern Blues Restoration Partnership is now 5 years into a 10-year project working to protect communities from wildfire, restore biodiversity, and reintroduce healthy fire to the landscape in Northeast Oregon. Fire ecologists say over 100 years of aggressive logging paired with fire suppression in the West has set the stage for catastrophic wildfires. But now, says Casey Radcliffe of the Nature Conservancy, with guidance from indigenous burning practices along with decades of research, the relationship to fire is shifting.
Land managers now are saying, well, we were trying to stop this thing, control it. We actually need to welcome it back in a way that feels like it's safe for our communities, but really results in much better outcomes than we could do without it.
Made up of a coalition of tribes, state agencies, landowners, and NGOs, the Northern Blues Restoration Partnership is working on 10 million acres across 13 counties in Northeast Oregon and Southeast Washington. Micah Schmidt is with the Oregon State University Extension Fire Program, another member of the partnership. He aims to equip more people with the skills and resources to conduct prescribed burns on non-federal lands. This is being done through job training with the Northwest Youth Corps and public weekend trainings.
No matter how much funding we throw at any agency to fund this work and do that, it all helps a ton, but we need individuals to take things in their own hands because we have a huge landscape and landowners and individuals that want to do some work are going to be a big piece of that.
Radcliffe says the challenge is so large, working together is key, adding that any effort needs to activate local expertise.
We found that a place-based collaboration is the way for us to sustain each other and actually start to make progress on the problem.
Research, including a study of Oregon's 2021 Bootleg Fire, shows forests treated with mechanical thinning and prescribed burns significantly reduced fire severity and made firefighting safer. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
A new survey finds more Americans are not raking and bagging their leaves, which has many environmental benefits. Yard waste, like leaves, are major contributors of waste in landfills across the U.S. Simone Perez reports from Virginia.
More Virginians are leaving leaves on the ground during the autumn season, providing a boon to local ecosystems and cutting down on methane gas in the atmosphere. A new survey by the National Wildlife Federation found that nearly 20% of people don't collect or remove fallen leaves during autumn, up from 15% last year. But nearly a third of people report throwing away six or more bags of leaves each season. David Mizajewski with the National Wildlife Federation explains that bagging leaves and sending them to the landfill contributes to climate change. When leaves and other organic yard waste are put in landfill piles and deprived of oxygen, they decompose and release methane into the atmosphere.
Who would have thought that a simple choice of what to do with your leaves in the fall could actually have a tie to something as big and massive as global climate change? But it's really true. There is a connection.
Methane is more than 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide in trapping heat in the atmosphere. Many people, however, don't have the choice to leave the leaves. The survey found 40% of people are required to bag their leaves by a homeowners association or city ordinance. Mizajewski says leaves left on the ground provide many benefits to local ecosystems and can save people money.
They suppress weeds, they retain soil moisture, and they also then slowly compost right in place and return the nutrients right to the root zone of the plants. That sounds an awful lot like mulch and fertilizer.
Leaf removal methods also pour harmful toxins into the atmosphere. According to Rutgers University, leaf blowers release chemicals such as carbon monoxide and nitrogen dioxide into the air that worsen respiratory issues and contribute to many chronic diseases. I'm Zimon Perez, Virginia News Connection.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 9th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, David Rosenberg, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lauren Schmidt, Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Zimon Perez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. First, the Trump corruption machine goes on. The corruption endemic that always comes with the Trump presidency is on in full force these days. There's Trump's Bitcoin operation, Mar-a-Lago,